Hello, fellow listeners. This is fellow worker Noah with WOB Radio. I'm joined with another fellow worker of our branch, Miguel.
Yep, this is Miguel. He, him pronouns. I am the social media officer for the Tacoma IWW branch, and I've been a member since 2020. It's great to be here, and thanks, Eric, for being here. It's a pleasure.
This evening, we are joined with Eric King. Eric, could you go ahead and introduce yourself for our fellow listeners? Maybe just a brief description of who you are and the kind of work that you do.
Hello, friends. My name is Eric King. I'm an anarchist and recently released critical prisoner. Right now, I am just knees deep in abolitionist work and trans liberation work, and just trying to do what I can to push the liberation struggle forward now that I'm free.
So, how did you get involved in your kind of liberation-related work in the beginning? I know that a big part of your story was your time in prison, but leading up to that, what kind of activism were you involved in?
Thank you for asking that. I was involved in the anarchist community in Kansas City, where I'm from, and then also like briefly in like places like Glasgow or Manchester, where I lived a little bit. But the sort of activism I was in was like class war activism. I had grown up and witnessed people in my community, my own family, go through serious evictions, go through vicious landlords, go through predatory banks and things like that. And so I saw this happening to poor people, to all people that didn't have the means to live a sheltered, like comfortable lifestyle, a life that was built on like all the things you have and have access to. And so that really shaped like how I grew up and like what I valued. And so my activism in the streets revolved around like finding food, finding housing, finding clothes, finding warmth for myself and also like other people in my community. For a while, we had a free daycare, and that was so that like single moms and like single parents in general, it was always moms, but it was open to anyone, could go to work, because not everyone can afford to pay $10 an hour for a babysitter. We did things like cleaning up lawns and cleaning up driveways for our neighbors and people in our community who didn't have the physical ability to do it or the money to pay the city to do it. And so then there was also like just classic like vicious vandalism and arsons of things that we didn't feel were necessary in the community, like attacking payday loan places, attacking banks. When I say attacking, I mean like minor vandalisms or like jamming locks and things like that. Just me ways to just try to strike a blow against capitalism any way we could. We were young.
Yeah, I was gonna ask. I was just like, people when you think of the word attack, I think especially towards like anarchists or other forms of ideologies or activism, people usually think, oh, it's violence against people. Like you're getting violent against people, and it's like, well, you can also have a few dozen of your friends storm like the construction site of an LNG plant, for example, like what
Yeah.
happened here in Tacoma. That's violence against
Ooh.
capital. That's a violence against a form of production, not necessarily a human being that might be involved in it.
Our big thing was jamming the locks of payday loan places, because they're so predatory that like we'd stick like toothpicks in them, break them, and then do the super glue so that if nothing else, they'd have to pay a couple $100 to get a locksmith out there, and it would shut down business for a couple hours. So just trying to strike a blow.
So yeah, it sounds like you were really involved in kind of like mutual aid work. I know that some of our fellow listeners might be familiar with that, but like essentially providing networks of support and care that are not typically available, especially towards working class people and the marginalized in a capitalist economy like ours,
Well
giving the
said.
people what they actually need to live.
And like they give stuff back. So it's a mutual aid. Like I might be able to help with clothes, but you might be able to help with teaching me how to sew or teaching me how to fight or, just different skill sets that we can share and like raise each other up together instead of like drowning together or drowning separate.
I've definitely been involved with some mutual aid in our particular corner of the country as well. I've definitely bumped elbows with people who organize things like food drives, childcare. I know that
Childcare,
there's a couple of
especially.
tool libraries here as well. I believe there's one up in Kitsap as well as down here in Tacoma that are mutual aid related organizations where you can actually like trade like yard equipment
Oh.
or like auto equipment, construction equipment, things like
Oh my
that.
God, that's such a great idea. 'Cause I just got this new house, not new, it's super old, but like I'm learning how necessary and expensive tools are. That's a great idea.
But yeah, it's the little things like that where you think, oh, well, you know, a circular saw, when am I ever going to need that? And then suddenly there's a hole in your roof, or, you know, there's some damage to your floor. And it's like, okay, actually, it would be really cool if I could afford this thing, but I can't. It's such an expensive piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. Then there are tool libraries. What are some of the lessons that you've kind of learned out of that experience being involved in, you know, mutual aid and active against the structures of capitalism, as you could put it?
I always saw capital as an enemy, even like when I didn't understand it. Even when I was a child and I just saw like the sheriffs coming and like moving people's stuff out of their houses and the people weeping, like my neighbors, myself, like experiencing these things. I didn't have the words for it, but I knew like capital is the enemy and the state is the protector of capital. And so what I learned doing through this is that like we are our own protectors. Like we are a community and we can do for ourselves. We don't need the state. We don't need the banks. We don't need the corporations. Like we can do this if we put in the effort and the time. And like these things showed me like one, like how badly people need help in this system. People, including myself at that time, like food was scarce. Like warmth was scarce. Heat was scarce. And so I learned like the state's not going to protect us. The state's not going to give us what we need to keep ourselves alive. But we can do that ourselves as a community. If we decide to, if we prioritize that over accumulating wealth or accumulating resources and then hoarding them, basically. If we put our stuff together, like we don't need a government. We don't need a state to tell us what to do or how to survive. We can do that ourselves. But if we rely on them, we will suffer and we will die. Like we will be miserable. They will not keep us safe. So that's what it taught me. It taught me that people need help. People need each other. And that when we decide to, we can be that resource for each other. And it's a beautiful, valuable resource when we choose to use it or supply it.
Speaking from my own personal experience, I definitely grew up like white and what people in this country would consider upper middle class. So okay. Like actually having to witness a lot of those hardships, like, you know, evictions or a lack of availability of food or services that would be, you know, not extremely tangible for other people. It was never like incredibly apparent to me, but I do remember as a kid, you know, there's always been a pretty decent houseless population here in Tacoma. And as I got older, I would remember looking out of my dad's truck and being like, I can recognize these individual people that I keep seeing again and again and again for years and years and years. And it was almost like this specter of, if you don't, you know, produce or perform economically as well as you are now, there's always that threat of you could sink further into the lower working class. You know, poverty is always a threat biting at your heels. And I think in a very roundabout way, it kind of helped, you know, radicalize me later in life, especially in 2019, 2020 during the COVID pandemic and everything. And I was like, oh, crap, there's that specter again. But now it's now everybody's on the same page. Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, as corny as the phrase is, you don't realize when something is a threat until it's pointing right at you. And you're like, oh, crap. Like everyone's going through the same thing. There's a moment of solidarity here. And like you said, you know, you see the opportunity for action and you need to take it. Fellow worker Miguel, did you have any questions?
I kind of wanted just to hear a little bit more about Eric's story. And obviously, in terms of being a political prisoner, because here in Tacoma, we have the Northwest Detention Center, where it houses, I believe, around 1,500 people who are detained because of immigration issues. It's a immigration detention center. And so I kind of wanted to wait for Eric's kind of story, because I know a lot of maybe what's happening in these prisons is also happening. We know that it's also happening in these detention centers because they're all also run by the same corporations too. So there is definitely a link.
Eric, I know that a big part of your story as an anarchist and as an activist is your time in prison.
Like what got me locked up?
There we go. Yeah.
I was, as we talked about, I was living in Kansas City and there was already like, I was doing my small little thing as we talked about. And then the pigs killed Michael Brown, the 18-year-old man in Ferguson. And that really, really affected me. That really hurt me because I saw the police in Kansas City are beyond abusive. Like, they are monsters. And I see nothing happen. I see no response in Kansas City when this stuff happens. And then in Ferguson, the community rose up and said, like, we've had enough. Like, we're tired of being treated like animals. We're tired of being dehumanized by this blue gang. And so when the pigs killed Michael Ferguson and like disgraced his body, just leaving it in the streets and just treated that community like you are below dirt, you are worthless. And I saw them rise up and I was just so moved by the collected rage and the righteous rage of this community to say, like, we're done. We're done dealing with this. Now you have to deal with us. And so that moved me and I was seeing nothing happening in Kansas City. And so I took a small trip to Ferguson and experienced a lot. Like, I saw the militias. I saw the National Guard. I got scars on me from the pigs shooting those little bombs that blow up and shoot the little rubber bullets. Mm-hmm. And they stick to you. If you're sweaty, those things will melt your skin. And I've got the scars on my arms. And so when I returned to Kansas City, I spoke to some people and there was nothing. People were not on the same page. And that's fine. Like, we don't all have to be on the same page, but I'm not going to let a lack of collective action prevent me from doing what I feel is right. I have my own conscience. I have to go to sleep at night with my own soul and figure out, like, did I do what I felt was right today? And I decided, like, let's get to work. So it started with, like, vandalizing some banks and stuff that were that funded police. And then it went to vandalizing, like, small, like, police cars and, like, letting out cop car, air out of tires, stuff like that. Like, on, they used to park their cars behind 12th and Locust, behind the jail. All their police cars would be there, so you could just go get every one of them at once. It was beautiful. I felt like these are stunts, basically. Like, these are stunts. Like, I'm being annoying, but I'm not showing real solidarity. I'm not doing enough. Because people were still dying in Ferguson after Michael Brown. People were dying in those protests. And so, if these cats are putting their lives on the line, like, why do I feel like I'm above them? Why is my life more precious than a poor black person's life in Ferguson? Like, it's not. And to act like it was like a position of privilege, because I can return back to my white privilege. They can't. So I thought, I need to go after a symbol of government. I need to go after a symbol of law. And I don't know if my target was best. I don't know if it was the most well thought out, but there was a congressman's office in the middle of downtown Kansas City, within like walking distance of the squad I was staying at. So, bingo. So I got some Molotov cocktails and I lit them. First, I broke the senator's window or congressman's window is about the size of like two hands put together. So it is a small window and I broke it out and it's like 10 feet up. It's not eye level. So I threw a hammer and busted it. And then I threw the first Molotov and it hit the window frame. And this is a brick building. So it basically just fizzled out. I was like, gosh, damn it. So I threw the second one and I wasn't even close. Wasn't even close to the window. Then I ran. And so then for the next week, I went about little crime business, doing the insurrectionist thing in my mind. And about a week later, they rolled up on me when I was walking my friend's dog. Had their guns, had their gang available and said, you know, put your hands up. You know what time it is. And that's what led to me being arrested and then doing the next 9 years and 5 months in prison.
Wow. And I mean, even for an act of vandalism, you didn't do that much damage. I also read an article.
I tried.
I also read another article online specifically about you and your case. You pretty much like looked around the building to make sure that no one was there. You mentioned earlier this was just solely an act of violence against property as protest.
Yeah, that was massively important to me because the last thing I want to do is like there's some dude in there, probably a black or brown person working like just to support their family, and all of a sudden they're getting firebombed. Like that would have been a nightmare. Like I couldn't have lived with myself if I had hurt some like janitor or something. So this was like, I watched it for like 5 days to see like, when does the janitor show up? When do they leave? Is there any cop cars present? Is there like real security? And once it was decided that like, this is safe, buildings don't have feelings. Buildings don't report back to their families. Like, they are objects and they represent state repression a lot of times. And so that building was a legit target in my mind for that. And because there was no risk of hurting people.
And you said that they arrested you about a week after this happened.
Yeah, I had a good solid, I was on the run for a good solid 5 days, 6 days. It was sweet. It was nerve wracking. It wasn't sweet actually, but it was nice being free.
Once you were detained, obviously they process you, they book you, they put you in jail. I know that Unicorn Riot covered your case pretty extensively. That's actually where I have some of the background information on some of your previous work. What was the court process like, I guess? What is it like to stand before a court and say, look, I did this. It was specifically an act of vandalism against a building in protest over some heinous things that the police department were doing. What was that like? Because I've never been in any part of the legal or penal system at all. And I imagine some of our listeners, especially here in North Tacoma, probably haven't either.
And I hope you never will. I hope that never comes to your doorstep. But let me all say, Unicorn Riot are amazing. Like, they started repping me from day one, and they're still doing it. Like, they were there the day I got released from ADX. I still meet up with them about once every 2 weeks. Like, they're filming a documentary right now. So I love Unicorn Riot. But the judicial system is humiliating, it's degrading, and it's enraging. You are already in the most powerless, vulnerable position you can be in. Because, at least in my case, I didn't get let out pretrial. So I'm in jail this entire time at a for-hire, like a paid contractor of the government, CCA. So they're a for-profit prison. So they make things as rough as possible, as shitty as possible. And then you go in front of a judge. And so every time I went in front of him, he disrespected me in some way, calling me mentally ill, refusing my request to get a new lawyer, just like small things like that. And then when it finally came down, I had to take a plea deal because my mandatory minimum was going to be at least 15 at most life. We didn't really have a choice when it came to trial. And like, we could have did the political trial and got 15 just to make a statement. So I took a plea deal and then I chose my plea hearing to then make a statement. And that was the only time I felt any power that whole time. Because in the courtroom, like, the marshals wouldn't let me turn around and look at my wife. They wouldn't let me like say I love you to her. They wouldn't let me acknowledge the people that came down. And so I got a chance to like tell that judge, I hate your system. I hate what you stand for. I hate what you represent. I hate this government. I hate the racism. I hate the homophobia. I do not regret what I did. I do not have compassion for a system that is okay murdering poor black and brown people for sport, basically, for fun. And so that was the only time during that entire 16 or 18 months, however long it was, that I felt any sort of like control or autonomy. And if you can imagine like going a year and a half of complete powerlessness over your own future. And so getting to have that statement and getting to call out that judge in person felt amazing. But like, even as soon as I was done, he called me mentally ill, said, I hope you get the mental care you need. Like, he still tried dehumanizing me. He still tried diminishing the stance I had taken as if it wasn't a political stance, as if it was an act of like mental health. And that's so insulting, as you can imagine. After that, then you go to real prison. Then it's prison time.
Did anyone know who you were when you got into prison?
So I started in prison at a low security facility because I had no criminal history. I had a college background. I was over the age of 27. The BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, classifies what security level you're going to be at based off like criteria like that. So no criminal history, no gangs, no weapons, like no guns, no drugs, college education. So I got to go to a low security, and the staff there hated it. So I had like moderate news coverage, but I had crazy support. So I was getting 10 or 20 books a week, 50 or 60 letters a week. And that got the attention of other prisoners, some of whom were just, not everyone likes seeing people have love. And then I was also like an outspoken, like anti-racist, pro-trans, pro-gay. And so I got a lot of hate for that, but it's at a low security. So no one's going to do anything, but the guards were going to do things. So the guards went out of their way to like search my cell and steal my books, steal my mail, take me to SIS, the Special Investigative Services, over and over, delay my mail, hang up my phone calls, harass my family when they came to visit me, those sort of things were so prevalent. And that's like, that's stuff that like most activist prisoners will go through, because the cops, no matter what your crime, if you're there for like a leftist activist stance, they're going to hate you and you're going to get this sort of treatment. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I guess, you know, on one hand, there are prisoners that envy or feel the lack of love and appreciation that you're getting from the outside, and they might resent you for that. But the power that the guards and the prison system have, especially as a political prisoner, to make your life hell, that's magnitudes of degrees worse. I can't even imagine. Did some of the prisoners give you support once they heard your story?
At the low, they did. At the low, I had a lot of gay friends, a lot of like, I was just so like, I was able to like just express solidarity with the people I was around. When I got to the higher custody levels, no, there was no support. There was vitriol. There was hatred for what I did, because I'm considered a race traitor at that point. They don't see the anti-cop. They see the pro-black. And like, I've got face tattoos for like the date that the first sit-in ever happened during the civil rights movement, stuff like of the Haymarket riot. The higher up in custody you get, the more intense the racial segregation is in prison. And at that point, there was no support. It was all violence and hatred. But at the low, that first 2 months at a low, there was, yeah, I had lots of friends, lots of support. Some of those people I still talk to now. But yeah, when you get in higher custody, it gets real nasty. And you do not have friends that support your actions. No.
How did you eventually get moved up to higher security in regards to the imprisonment facilities that you were at? Because I know that, of course, the guards and the prison system was giving you a lot of crap for the kind of activist work that you were involved in. Could you give kind of a brief summary as to how that happened?
Yeah, of course. So I had the rare distinction. I think I'm one of like maybe the only prison administrators told me I was the only, and I haven't met anyone yet, person who's been through all four custody levels. So I've been to a low, a medium, a USP, the penitentiary, and then the supermax, the ADX. And I did that within like 4.5 years. It's wild. I went from a low to a medium because I had sent my wife some mail and there was poems, like anti-cop poems, because that's how I was like expressing my rage at being in prison. And the cops said I was threatening staff, and they went and grabbed me from work one day, handcuffed me, and drove me right to Florence, 2.5 or 2 hour drive, whatever. And so I was at Florence for 16 months. 4 of those were in the SHU and SEG. And I was doing activism stuff there. And then I got attacked by a lieutenant one day for mocking his friend for getting beat up. Another lieutenant got beat up, and I emailed my wife making fun of it. And this lieutenant got really upset about it, picked a fight with me, and I laughed in his face and he punched me. And so I dog walked him. I whooped his ass. That got me beaten severely. It got me four point tortured. And then that led to the next five and a half years I was in and out of SEG. And they prosecuted me. They took me to USP McCreary, where I was waiting to see if I was going to be prosecuted. And I was there for like 5 days, and staff got me jumped by a Missouri Nazi. They put me in a isolated area with this guy. He jumped me, and I did fine. I didn't get hurt. That got me transferred to another penitentiary. And then I was there for 10 days, and they brought me back to Colorado to face prosecution for defending myself against that lieutenant. And so I spent 2.5 years in a 6x8 cell, no phone calls, no visits, no email, fighting this case, fighting a federal case while already a federal prisoner. And Unicorn Riot covered that pretty thoroughly too. And I ended up winning. I took it all the way to trial. I was not going to sign another plea deal ever again in my life. Not after that first one. And so I took it to trial, and a jury agreed that like I was right to defend myself. So that humiliated the Bureau, humiliated them, because like they have something like a 95% success rate in trials and like 99% when it comes to prisoners facing additional charges. While I was pre-trial on that case, some people from Colorado ended up doing a noise demo at Inglewood. That's where they held me for the pre-trial. And during the noise demo, they live streamed it. And people were like shooting off fireworks, and someone like busted a cop's windows in their car. And so they accused me of orchestrating that, despite me not having mail, not having phone, not having visits. Like, I literally had no contact with the outside world. But so after that, after I went at trial and after that happened, they started the ADX referral process. And that's like where El Chapo is. That's where like some of the 9/11 bombers are. They said I was the leader of Antifa. that I orchestrated riots outside prisons.
You had the little CEO placard on your desk.
Exactly. And like, we all know how stupid that is. We know how ridiculous that is, but they don't. They take it real serious. And so they didn't think it was funny. Like, they really thought that I was orchestrating riots outside prisons because they're so stupid. But that got me sent to the federal superbacks, the underground rabble, like 24-hour lockdown prison. And that's where I did the last year and a half of my bid before getting released.
Wow. That's incredible. They just kept bumping you up the levels.
It was crazy. Because I'm a soft guy. Like, I'm not hyper violent. I had one fight in prison that I got caught for. I there was lots of fights, but like one disciplinary write-up for fighting, never getting caught with knives, never stabbed no one, never extorted anyone, never robbed anyone. But because I was that lieutenant and beat it in trial, and then had that protest, and it was ridiculous, over the top.
Yeah, public enemy number one. You said that you made it all the way up to Supermax, right? What was Supermax like? Because, I mean, you see, like, news documentaries and stuff like that, but you hardly ever get a chance to talk to someone who's been in a Supermax and got out.
So it's weird, because, like, you do see all these, like, news stories about it. I never dreamed I would set foot in that prison, but you hear about it. Like, my entire bid, like, people talk about that place like a majestic faraway land. Like, it's got like folk tales about it. So you don't know what to expect. And honestly, I was terrified because it's the same guards there that were like stomping my head in when they were torturing me at the medium. Like, they're all the same guards. And so I thought I was going to get brutalized or killed or whatever. And then you get there and you realize like this isn't a physical torture place. This is a psychological torture place. Like, this prison is designed to break your mind, not your body, to destroy your mind. And I was stunned at how effective it was at crushing people. You get there and like day one and every day, they're all the same day. You are in I think a 9x12 box. And it's not like the normal like steel cells where you can bang on the door and talk to your friends. It's thick concrete. You have a little slit in your window so you can only see like a wall. There's a wall outside and maybe like an inch of light. You can't hear nothing. Unless someone's banging on the shower and they're like, because we have showers in our cell. You shower in your room. And so you can't talk to the people next to you. And then you have two doors. Each cell has two doors, an inside door that has like bars on it. And then there's like a little vestibule area and then an outside door. And so like if the guards want to bring you food to eat, because you eat in your cells, you never leave your cells. They open the outside door, bring your tray of food, sit it on the bars on the inside door, walk out, close the outside door, and then you can like grab your food. So you have no contact with anyone. After 10 days, I got a you get a TV, and that TV is essentially your babysitter. Like, it becomes a prison guard, because if you're not paying attention, you'll end up obsessing over the TV. It'll become your life. You'll stop reading. You'll stop writing letters. You'll stop working out. The TV becomes like almost like a chain in itself to chain you into compliance, to chain you into docileness, to make you infant. You spend at least 22 hours in a cell by yourself, 22 and a half hours a day, 22 and a half. Some days you get indoor rec, which you handcuff your hands behind your back. Two guards, one with a steel baton, they take you to a different box, and that's your inside rec cage, and you're by yourself. Or you go to outside rec, and it's the same thing. You are by yourself, you're in a little cage, and you do an hour of exercise.
Now, you said you only have 2 hours a day outside of your cell on average, correct?
It's an hour and a half. Yeah, you get that about 3 days a week if you're lucky.
I mean, did you ever get a chance to meet any of the other prisoners while you were there? Because, I mean, like you said, it's some pretty high-profile people that end up in prisons like that. And no offense, yeah, you don't really seem like the kind of person who belongs in a supermax prison.
No, I don't. Firstly, like, I don't think anyone belongs in a supermax prison. If we're going by like the standards that they set, like, no, I had no business there. I'm not violent. I'm not high profile. I don't have any sort of high influence on like radical groups, but I did. I got to meet a lot of really, really great and interesting people. They let the orderlies out. So the orderly gets an hour out of the cell and he gets to push a broom around the range for an hour. So I got to meet multiple orderlies. What you realize is that almost everyone there, besides the high-profile people, are either there for violently assaulting staff, a high influence in a gang, like a leadership role in a gang, like a real deal leadership, or they killed somebody. Most of these killings were accidents. Some were like they just felt they had to. I got to meet some of the leaders of the Nuestra Familia, and they were just so kind. Like, these dudes are so respectful, but they have immense power within prison. So some of them have been in prison since the 70s. They're old men. I got to meet Larry Hoover, the leader or founder of the GDs. He's an old man. He's in his 80s. He's been in prison for like 50 years. I got to meet Jeff Ford, who provided security for Martin Luther King in the 60s in Chicago. I got to meet Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. That's what they call him. And some of the units, like when you go out to wreck and you're in your little outside wreck in your cage, and some of the units, you can see like other units' windows, and you can yell to them, and like they can try to yell back through the window. And so I got to talk to Richard that way. We might find his crime deplorable, but he's never getting out of that prison. He'll be in that prison until the day he dies. And he's not a bad person. I mean, some people, I met a guy who like cut open this kid's stomach and pulled out his intestines and shoved it in his mouth over $30. Like, he might have some like mental health issues he needs to work through. But like, what you realize is like the worst of the worst that you're told, the worst of the worst are people. They're people with families, and they're people with hopes and dreams. And most of them will never, ever see freedom again or anything, or even see prison outside of ADX again. Some of these people had been in ADX for 20 years and will be there for another 20 unless they die before that. And it really shows you, like, it affects you if you have empathy, because I don't want to see anyone suffer that way. I don't care if you try to blow up a plane in protest of U.S. imperialist invasions. Like, that might be a gross crime, but like, you have a heart too. And I don't like seeing the government. I don't like forfeiting the power to destroy people to the government. And so like, I learned a lot of empathy. I learned a lot about prison abuse. I learned a lot about how far this government will go to hurt people that oppose it or that stand against it. Like, I met people that had been next to Ramzi Youssef and had been next to the Boston Marathon bomber and had met Palestinian fighters. I met multiple jihadis, and like, I got along with every one of them because like, they're humans. They're humans, and they have passions too, and they care about things too. And just because the government says that they're bad doesn't mean that like that label has to stick and that I have to view them through governmental lenses, if that makes sense.
Speaking of prison abuse, I know that earlier in this interview, you mentioned, you know, being placed in solitary, aka the shu, and you also mentioned something regarding 4-point torture as well. Yeah. If you're comfortable answering the question, could you please describe some of the abuse that you experienced in prison? Because I don't think a whole lot of people are really cognizant of how prisons can get away with that.
Well, they can. So I would encourage anyone listening to Google 4-point prison restraints. And what happened to me was, after I had defended myself against that lieutenant, a gang of about 7 or 8 guards stomped me half to death, knees, kicks, punches, elbows. And then they took me into a room, cut off all my clothes, butt naked with scissors. Like, it was like a gang stripping, for real. Like, they slam you against the wall, your face against concrete. They use sharp knives or shears, cut off every single bit of your clothing, put some small boxers on you, and then they chain you to a bed. And they chain you with your right arm as far stretched as it can go, and then your left arm as far up and stretched as it can go, and then your left foot, and then your right foot. The cuffs are digging into your skin. Like, I still can't feel part of my right hand and part of my left hand. And then they leave you there. And they can leave you there for as long as they want. And they left me there for 7 hours. 7 hours laying on this bed, stretched out. You can't move. And within minutes, your body starts cramping. Within minutes, your muscles start rebelling. And I had to piss on myself. They're not letting you up to use the bathroom. I had to stifle the screams because I didn't want to give them the satisfaction. But like, inside, you feel every muscle screaming like fire. It feels like someone's taking a poker, like an iron poker, jamming it into your shoulders, jamming it into your spine, jamming into your wrists. And your mind goes in wild directions. I had to spend almost all my energy just trying to center, like, this has an ending. Like, I'll survive this. I can survive this. At other times, guards would intentionally put people in your cell just because they knew that you would end up fighting those people. In the penitentiary system, you're not allowed to cell with another race. You can't do it in the shoe anywhere. And so the guards on a couple times, put someone in my cell just so that person would fight me, just because they hated what I stood for. And then they watch you fight. Some of these fights lasted like 15, 20 minutes, bloodbath. Like picture like two men like in a small hot cage covered in blood. And then the guard's been watching it the whole time. They open the door and they pepper spray you. And then they pepper spray you again. And then they pepper spray you again just to watch you burn and scream. I had, for about 2 years, I had what's called a general correspondence restriction. That's where you're not allowed to write mail. People think like, oh, so mail's a right. Like everyone can have mail. No, they can take it. And they do. And so for 2 years, I wasn't allowed to write anyone but my wife. But then they know that. They know that's your only means of communication. So they would throw away those letters or just not give them to me. They would just refuse to give them to me. And so that becomes a psychological torture in itself because I'm not allowed to make phone calls. I'm not allowed to visit. And now I'm not allowed to hear from my family. During COVID, while I'm fighting this new case, facing 20 more years in prison, at one point, Officer Gustafson from FCI Inglewood, while I was pretrial, I was handcuffed behind my back in my underwear in the shower because they were searching my cell. And me and him got an argument because he's just a huge piece of trash. And this 6'4", 280-pound man picks me up and slams me on my head. People won't be able to see it, but there's this huge scar right here. I had to go to the hospital. I blacked out. I had 7 stitches, a massive concussion. I was puking for days. Had vertigo for like a month and a half. I could have died. I went 5 years without making a phone call. 5 years without making a phone call. I went 5 years without, 5.5 years without having a contact visit. At ADX, you don't get contact visits. You are in a concrete booth with an inch thick glass and you have to talk over the phone so that they can disconnect it if they want to. So that's the sort of torture. And I'm not even mentioning the small stuff, the room searches, the anal searches, the throwing away your pictures, the trashing your cells. Like these are just the hard, big things. The small things happen on an almost daily basis sometimes. Prison's real. It sucks.
5 years without being able to make a phone call. What was your family struggling with on the outside? Because I mean, I imagine it's difficult for them in that situation to kind of check in on you and just know that you're alive in the first place.
I mean, I'm not going to lie and pretend like it was easy. They suffer. Like the family of political prisoners need more support because they suffer hard, especially if that prisoner is facing repression. And so like my wife went through it. Like I had to miss every birthday. I had to miss every Christmas and not just not be here, but not be able to talk during it. And so like my kids grew up without me. The prison uses that to abuse them too. My wife would send me vulnerable letters, like sad, just like, I don't know what's happening. Like, I am so scared. Like, I don't want to lose you for 20 years. And at one point the cops took these letters and sent them to Child Protective Services in Colorado. That's illegal. You cannot do that. But they did it. And like my wife had to have these cops the Child Protective Services cops show up at her door. And the referral said that her anti-fascist politics made her a threat to her children. So they used her politics to try to get our kids taken away. Like, and we have a lawsuit against them for doing this. Like we've got lawsuits, but like they'll never like pay the price for that. There'll never be any justice for that. And they don't care. Like that's torture. They were torturing my family. They don't have hearts about this. They don't have empathy. They don't see your family as real people that love you and like are devoted and like care. They see them as enemies. They see them as scum. And so like, yeah, it's hard. It's hard. And these pigs will do what it takes to break you and break your family if they want to.
After a year and a half, you said, in Supermax, mm-hmm. You finally get out. What exactly led to that? Because I know that you were kind of on the table for some pretty serious prison time, even before all of the events that transpired while you were incarcerated occurred. I guess, what's getting out of prison like?
That's a neat question, too. Getting out of prison is weird because you have this idea in your head that you're told, like, once you're free, everything's perfect. Like, oh, man, at least you're free. But you still have these scars. Like, I still have a lot of trauma I got to work through. And then I still have to, like, heal with my family. And that's tough. Getting out of prison is both the like best feeling and the weirdest feeling. Cause like everything felt just a little different. Like I've never had a smartphone. I've never had these sort of like tech. I've never used an app. I've never used a streaming service. Everything's just a little different. So it becomes like almost disorienting. But I am one of the like most privileged people on earth because I left prison with a wife and kids that were there still with me. Because I didn't isolate them. I had a job when I got out at Bread and Roses Legal Center here in Denver. I had a place to live. I had access to a vehicle. I was blessed beyond belief. I cannot literally imagine how hard it is for people that come out without that, because the prison system doesn't help you. They don't set you up to succeed. They don't like help you find a job and like give you clothes and give you money and like give you things to help get you on your feet. They dump you in a halfway house and say like, good luck, do your best. If not, you're going to be homeless. I was blessed. And like, I've been blessed. Like, I get to do interviews. I get to do these podcasts, and I get to be friends with all these people that supported me when I was inside. And I get to be an abolitionist. I get to do this because I have that privilege, but so many people don't. And like, I still think about my friends inside all the time. I've got a friend inside ADX. His name is Randy Platt. We were pretrial together at Inglewood, and he's still got 11 years left there. So like, I'm trying to still always raise money for him, try to get people to send him books, because I feel like I left people behind that deserve love too. Like, the love I'm getting, they deserve too. And so it's a weird feeling, because it's so beautiful, and every day is like the best day of my life. But I also still remember the fact that other people, every day is the worst day of their life. Mm-hmm. And you can't just shake that. If you've got a heart, like, you don't shake that. And so it's this juggling act of trying to do what you can for them while still counting like every single beautiful blessing you have, if that makes sense.
Especially considering all that you went through and the kind of conditions that you had to endure, you know,
it was hard.
No matter how long you're out of prison, you're always kind of carrying those experiences with you. And like you said, you know, all of that trauma that you go through is stuck in your head, and you have to find the resources for yourself to unpack that. Like you said, when you leave prison, yeah, you're not behind bars anymore, but now you are completely on your own in many cases.
Real talk, I cry all the time. Like, someone, like, my bosses will compliment me. I have amazing bosses, Z Williams and Erica Unger at Bread and Roses. They hired me as a paralegal. And like, they'll compliment me. Like, they'll genuinely like be happy with what I'm doing. And it'll cause me to weep because I went so long without any positive affirmations. So like, it's hard readjusting the scales of like what's normal and like what's okay in your brain. Like, I get upset when people don't say excuse me, because I'm so used to saying excuse me every time I walk by someone. People don't say it now, and I'll get mad. And my wife will have to be like, babe, it's like, it's not prison. Like, we don't say excuse me every 10 seconds here. So like, there's adjusting that it's real. And like, thank God I have the best wife on earth, best partner on earth, who understands trauma and complex PTSD and like what abuse is. I can see why people ruin relationships when they get out of prison, because if you don't know how to handle what you went through and you don't have people that are there for you, those emotions will manifest in sadness, anger, violence, depression, anxiety. I get that. People need help when they get out. People need help bad.
So now, you said you're currently working as a paralegal at Bread and Roses in Kansas?
Yeah. No, it's in Denver.
In Denver. My apologies. Yeah. So yeah, what's some of the work that you do now as a paralegal, being kind of on the other side, you know, trying to help people who are going through similar situations that you were? Because, I mean, I can only imagine the kind of, I mean, maybe this is a self-centered way of looking at it, but I can only imagine the kind of empowering feeling that it can give you to kind of be there and to put a hand on someone's shoulder and say, okay, I know you're going through a really, you know, you're staring down the barrel of the U.S. justice system, but I'm here to help you.
It is. So like, it's a two-part job. And so one part is civil rights stuff. We have a civil rights department, and that's like ran by Z, and that's focusing like really hard on trans liberation. And so I get to go to the Capitol, and I get to stand with my trans family and do rallies and go to Senate hearings and go to meet senators, meet congressmen, meet lawmakers, meet lobbyists, and try to ensure that the trans community is going to be safe in Colorado at least. So there's that side, which is the most beautiful feeling also. It's amazing. And then there's the criminal justice side, and that's with Erica. I get to do what little bit I can to at least give someone a chance within the system. I can't tell you how good that feels. There are no words to describe how good it feels to be on the other side and get to devote my time, my passion, what intellect I have, what skills I have, and get to devote that to people whose lives are on the brink of being crushed, whose families are looking down a lifetime without them. To be able to have that opportunity is not normal. Most people will get out of prison and not have that opportunity to have a career, to have people that believe in you. I see that as a huge blessing, and I also recognize it as a huge opportunity. And I use that opportunity and I take great pride in it because I want to help. I don't care what you did. I don't want you in prison. If you did something horrible, I want the community to take care of you. I want restorative justice, transformative justice to take care of you. I don't want you stuck in a concrete box so that the government can claim that they did a good job. I don't want them to take credit for anything. It's just the most beautiful feeling. I am blessed and I love my bosses and I support everyone to find Bread and Roses Legal Center on Instagram or Twitter and just show them love because they are great people. I'm blessed.
Speaking as a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, our labor union that produces this radio show, part of the organizing work that we do is trying to communicate to prisoners who, say, work in the private prison industry and they have to work while they're in prison. Of course, this also happens at government-run prisons as well. You know, convict leasing still occurs on a very regular basis. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. And those prisoners are workers and they deserve the right to collective action and to form a union, regardless of whether their workplace is, you know, behind bars or not. From your perspective of somebody who has been incarcerated, what are your hopes for the future for the conditions of prisoners, for people that have been through similar situations like you? You know, how can the IWW help in this as well?
This is a tricky one too, because I want to see the prison system tore down, but I also recognize clearly that we're not tearing it down, at least not today. And so I'm okay with people taking steps to make the life of prisoners better. I would rather, if we're going to coexist with prison right now until we get rid of it, then I'd rather the people inside have the best opportunities possible to expand their lives, their hearts, their minds, their abilities. I would love to see prisoners get living wages, at the least. And I would love to see these corporations get boycotted, called out, shut down, that have profited off of prison labor. Like, that's slave labor. There's no other, like, we can try to whitewash all we want and say, like, because there's not whips and stuff, that it's not slavery. But if you're getting told you have to do this job, or you don't get to talk to your family, or you don't get out of prison, that's extortion. Like, that's slavery. And so I would love to see unions and just people in general take this maybe a little more seriously, because I've never seen a boycott movement for organizations, for companies that profit off prison labor. I've seen Instagram posts and I've seen flyers, but I've never seen like a sort of like collective action and like a united movement. I'm not going to try to compare the two, but like what I see happening with like the mass movement to stop Cop City or to end the Israeli occupation and siege of Gaza, I see just a collective conscious decision to say, we're not going to stop talking about this. We're not turning a blind eye to this ever again. That sort of collective action can force a change, especially when it starts affecting money, when it starts affecting corporate bottom lines and shareholders. I would love with all my heart to see that sort of same energy devoted towards the abolitionist movement. I don't know how to make that happen. I don't have the skills to organize that well. I don't know how to push that forward besides doing what I can. We could shut down the for-profit prison industry. We could shut down prison slave labor. We could force better food into prisons. We could force better jobs. We could force better opportunities and training. But we have to put that heat on. In the federal system, Colette Peters, we need to put that heat on her the same way we're doing with Gaza. In the state system, like, we need to put the pressure collectively on these companies that profit. McDonald's, Dell Computer, TV Coffee, Cars, Trail Mix, and so on. There's hundreds of them. There's hundreds of them. But until we do that, they don't care about bad PR. Bad press isn't going to hurt them because their shareholders are still going to get that money. I would love to see that be the end of prisons, to where collective action rises up and say, we're done. We are done accepting this as our normal. Kind of like what Aaron Bushnell said, like, we're not going to accept this as our normal. We're done. We're done being okay with slavery and the 13th Amendment. We're not going to accept it. So that's what I would like to see. That's my goal, I hope.
You're right. You know, with what's going on with the siege in Gaza and the genocide that's occurring there, and, you know, other mass movements that have especially taken place over the past several months, this emphasis on, you know, we're going to keep talking about it until action is finally done. We're never going to forget what's happening now, nor ever again. We're going to keep putting the heat and the pressure on the people responsible for that kind of suffering in the world until they're eventually held accountable. I certainly hope that the IWW puts all of its effort into that as well. I know that a lot of different union branches and, you know, organizations that we've also partnered with are definitely involved in that work as well. Eric, I just want to say thank you so much. I know that a lot of what you've been through has been unjust and particularly cruel, both to you and your family and the people who love and support you. Is there any way that people can reach out to you in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I support people, by the way, to buy me and Josh Davidson's book, Rattling the Cages, an abolitionist book. Just going to throw that out there. Support Eric King on Instagram. Like, if you're interested in abolition, if you're interested in, like, talking about prison, if you're interested in just seeing what life is like after prison, like, hit me up. Or just follow. Or just support Write a Prisoner. I'll shoot you some names. If you're interested in writing prisoners, I'll hit me up and I'll shoot you some names. But that's how you can get a hold of me.
And I just want to thank our fellow listeners currently tuning in. This has been a production of WOB Radio. We want to thank all of our listeners at 101.9 KTAH, 95.3 KTQA, and 94.9 KZAX up in Bellingham. This has been a production of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. If you're interested in forming a union or getting involved, you can reach out to us at IWW.org, or you can reach out to us on our Facebook page and we'll get right back to you. Thank you so much again, Eric King. I wish you all the best in solidarity.
Thank you for everything. It was a pleasure. Have a great night.